You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
Okay, let's unpack this. Today we're doing a deep dive into, well, the really fascinating world of the Australian startup ecosystem. It's vibrant, it's always changing.
Absolutely, and we've gathered insights from, you know, a whole range of people, founders, investors, journalists, the folks actually building the ecosystem.
Right, people who haven't just watched it happen, but have actively shaped it. And our mission really is to give you a shortcut to understanding its whole journey.
From those pretty humble beginnings, right up to where it is now.
Yeah, uncovering the strengths, which might surprise some people, the challenges that still persist, and what's actually coming next.
Get ready for some real aha moments, I think. Because it gets really interesting when you look at how this whole innovation culture was built almost from, well, almost from scratch.
It really is an amazing story. And to get how far it's come, you really have to wind the clock back to the early 2000s, maybe even the early 2010s.
Yeah, back then, the whole idea of a startup, it just wasn't common. For a lot of people, it basically didn't exist as a concept.
Like Dharmika Mistry, the scientist, she said that back in 2010, the word startup just didn't even exist for her. Her IP got taken, and she just didn't know what to do next.
That's incredible, isn't it? It wasn't just about a lack of money or buildings.
No, it was fundamental. The language, the mindset around innovation wasn't really there yet.
Exactly. If a top scientist didn't even have the word in her vocabulary, it just shows you what a blank slate they were starting from.
And Steve Grace, he started a recruitment company way back in 2003. He said there wasn't any big fuss around startups until maybe 10 years later.
Right. And Joshua Flannery, his first tech job in 2004, he described it as feeling totally isolated, like he wasn't really part of any ecosystem at all.
Makes you think about how bold those early folks really were, just stepping out into the unknown.
Absolutely. That early time was defined by, well, a real lack of structure, support infrastructure. Dharmika Mistry mentioned it. Brad Parsons, too, even though he started a bit later in 2015.
But that gap, that void, it kind of sparked creativity, didn't it? People couldn't just wait around for the infrastructure.
No, they had to actually create it themselves, build it as they went.
And that's where we start seeing the community actually taking physical shape, right? The first places people could gather.
Yeah. Co-working spaces like Fish Burners.
Yeah.
That kicked off in Sydney around 2012.
Kim Harris called Fish Burners the first physical representation of that Sydney startup community, a place where people finally, you know, understood what you were doing.
Crucial. A place to connect, share those war stories, build relationships. And Melbourne had YBF Ventures, another early hub.
It's like these places were the first, I don't know, literal homes for the Aussie startup dream.
Totally. And it wasn't just physical spaces. The ecosystem started getting more formal with early accelerator programs, too.
Like PushStart. That was around 2010.
Yeah, PushStart. And then StartMate came along. They started giving that initial guidance, mentorship, a bit of structure.
And even before that, those informal meetups were important, weren't they? Like the Web Directions conferences John Alsop started.
Oh, hugely important. Back in 2004, they brought together all these web people who felt isolated, helped forge those early connections. That became the foundation later on.
Okay, so sparks of community, places to meet, but every entrepreneur knows that's not enough on its own. You need capital. What was the funding scene like then? How did anyone get off the ground?
Well, in 2013, journalist Yolanda Redrup said rounds under $1 million were pretty standard. Getting $5 million, that was a big deal.
Wow, just $5 million.
Yeah, and Marcus Kalbitzer pointed out there just weren't many professional investors around then. Funding often came from, you know, the usual suspects.
Family and friends.
Exactly, family and friends. And Yolanda Redrup stressed how much these early investors really took a big risk.
Because of the dot-com crash fallout.
Right. She called it a 10-year drought for venture capital in Australia after that. So anyone putting money into a startup back then was being pretty brave, almost going against the grain.
It sounds like a totally different universe. Investing when VC had basically dried up. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Let's talk about deep tech. This isn't your average app startup, is it?
Oh, definitely not. Dharmika Mistry defines deep tech really clearly. It's ideas, solutions coming straight out of STEM fields, science, tech, engineering, maths.
So not built over a weekend in a garage.
No way. These things take serious time.
Yeah.
Often like 8 to 10 years to even get to a commercial stage. They need huge amounts of capital and you're navigating complex approvals, regulations.
Yeah. She stressed it's not a fast turnaround, completely different from those bedroom or garage startups. It's about fundamental breakthroughs.
Exactly. Big science, big engineering.
Which brings us to a big hurdle for Australia, doesn't it? That gap between academia and industry. We hear a lot about Australia lagging in commercializing its science compared to other OECD countries.
We do, and it's a real challenge.
When Dharmika talks about universities focusing on their piece of the pie, their IP share, that sounds like more than just red tape. Is it a cultural thing?
I think it is, fundamentally. It's a deep cultural divide, almost a mindset issue. Universities are often set up to reward publication academic prestige.
Not necessarily commercial risk-taking or easy collaboration with industry.
Precisely. Mm. Dharmika saw it firsthand, universities prioritizing their IP slice over making collaboration genuinely smooth and seamless. The incentives often just don't line up.
That seems like a massive barrier to getting research out into the real world. So what's actually being done to try and bridge that divide?
Well, there are programs trying to tackle it, like the CSIRO Kickstart program.
Right. I've heard of that. What does it do?
Megan Seven explained it offers up to $50,000 in co-funding. But maybe more importantly, it gives early stage startups direct access to CSIRO researchers if they hit a scientific or technical roadblock.
So it's not just cash, it's expertise, embedding researchers with the startups.
Exactly. It forces that collaboration on a human level, tries to break down those silos person by person.
Any success stories from that?
Yeah, a good one is Australian plant proteins. With CSIRO's help, they developed a protein powder from fiber beans. It's actually being commercially manufactured now.
That's great. A tangible and probably tasty result.
Okay, let's zoom back out. How did the ecosystem evolve from those, you know, isolated early days to what we see now, say, from the mid-2010s onwards?
Well, the growth has just been incredibly rapid, real maturation. Alex Skander gave a great example with fintech.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
He saw the number of fintechs in Australia jump from maybe 100 or so in 2015 to over 800 by late 2018, early 2019.
Wow. 8 times growth in just a few years.
Incredible, isn't it? And there's been a huge amount of growth in investment, too. Much more institutional money coming in, especially for those later funding rounds. Marcus Kalbetzer and Wayne Girard both noted that.
And we've definitely seen some big success stories pop up. Companies like G1, Employment Hero, Yolanda Redrope was covering them when they were tiny. Now they're global players, unicorns even.
Absolutely. It really shows the ecosystem has matured, that Australia can produce these world-beating companies. And culturally, has anything shifted alongside that growth?
Yeah, significantly. There's definitely less of a fear of failure now, or maybe a bit less tall poppy syndrome, you know, that tendency to cut down successful people.
Ah, yes, the classic Aussie trait.
Yolanda Redrup sees that reduction as a sign of maturity. Although, it's fair to say Dharmika Mistry and Rick Richardson think those cultural habits still linger a bit. Cultural change is slow, right?
Always slow. Takes generations sometimes. Speaking of big shifts, what about COVID? That turned everything upside down. How did it hit the startup scene? Did it stall things, or was there maybe an unexpected upside?
It was definitely what Steve Grace called a violent change.
Mm.
But surprisingly, often it acted as a catalyst, an accelerator.
How so?
Well, Steve Grace pointed out it sped up the adoption of digital tech and remote work by maybe 5 or 10 years, almost overnight.
Right. Everyone went online, went remote.
And that forced shift could have accidentally pushed Aussie companies to think more globally. Peter Tippett mentioned this too. Suddenly, geography wasn't such a barrier. Your customers could be anywhere.
That's fascinating. A global pandemic forcing a global outlook. An accidental strategy pivot. But I thought Brad Parsons mentioned something else too, almost a counter trend. Something more local.
Yeah, that's right. Brad Parsons saw that while global thinking did increase, COVID also sparked a renewed focus on localization. More emphasis on local impact. Resilient supply chains closer to home.
So kind of a push and pull, global ambition strengthening alongside local resilience.
Exactly. A really interesting duality came out of it.
What about the people involved, the talent, the diversity in the ecosystem? Has that changed much?
I think one of the biggest wins is that it's normalized the idea of an entrepreneurial career path. It's seen as a real viable option now, even an aspirational one.
Which attracts more people, presumably.
Definitely. A much more diverse talent pool. Joshua Flannery reckons Australia punches above its weight in human resources because of this growing acceptance.
And diversity among founders and investors themselves, any progress there?
There's definitely been improvement, yes. But Yolanda Redrup made the crucial point that funding still goes disproportionately to all male teams.
Even though studies show diverse teams often get better results.
Exactly. So progress, yes, but still a way to go on that front. It's a persistent issue.
But it's good to hear about places like Western Sydney. Is that a good example of where this broader talent pool is really starting to shine?
Absolutely. Don Wright highlighted Western Sydney as a fantastic example. So much entrepreneurial talent emerging from its diverse multicultural communities.
Yeah.
It shows innovation isn't just an inner city thing.
Okay, so we've traced the evolution, looked at big impacts like COVID, the talent side. Let's talk about what makes Australia genuinely unique. What are its real standout strengths compared to, say, Silicon Valley or London?
I think the standout strength, the one everyone mentions, is the collaboration. It's described as mind-blowingly good and this pervasive give-first mentality.
Give-first. What does that mean in practice?
It means people are generally willing to help each other out, share advice, make connections, without necessarily expecting something immediately in return. Steve Grace and Pauline Fitawi really emphasize this.
So it's less cutthroat than Silicon Valley or the UK?
Significantly less competitive, much more supportive, generally speaking. Lots of experienced founders are actively giving back, mentoring, opening doors. It creates this really powerful pay-it-forward culture. Less time fighting, more time building.
That sounds like a huge advantage. A genuinely refreshing one. And besides that collaborative spirit, are there specific industries where Australia really punches above its weight, where it's carved out a niche?
Oh, for sure. Australia's developed real strengths in certain sectors. Software as a service, SaaS is a big one. Just look at Atlassian, Canva, global giants.
Right. Any others?
FinTech is strong, obviously, given the growth we talked about. AgriTech, too, which makes sense given Australia's agricultural base. And health tech, biomedical stuff. Yolanda Redrup and Wayne Girard mentioned those.
So it's about playing to our strengths. It's
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
John Alsop and Wayne Girard were clear on this. Australia should leverage these natural strengths rather than just trying to copy the Silicon Valley playbook. Be authentic. Build on what we have.
Wise advice. Don't just ape someone else. And with remote work becoming so normal, how does regional Australia fit in? Is talent outside the big cities finally getting noticed?
Definitely. Remote work has made regional talent much more valuable and accessible. It's not forgotten anymore, as Peter Tippett and Don Wright said.
So opportunity spreading out.
Yeah. And Daryl Lyons suggested regional centers, like Cairns and Townsville up north, should focus on collaborating with each other, not competing, to make the most of their resources. Tap into that Aussie give first thing locally.
And Western Sydney again comes up.
Absolutely. Huge, diverse population, massive investment going in. It's creating real local opportunities in construction, infrastructure, health, education. Innovation isn't just CBD skyscrapers anymore.
Okay. It sounds like the ecosystem has come an incredibly long way. It's resilient. It's got this unique collaborative vibe. But, you know, no system's perfect. What are the big challenges still holding things back? What keeps founders up at night?
Well, a big one that keeps coming up is that early stage funding gap. It still persists.
So, plenty of money for later stages, but harder to get started.
That's often the case. Professional investors tend to favor those later, maybe less risky rounds, as Marcus Kalbetzer pointed out. Steve Grace even called some early stage funding predatory.
Ouch. That bad.
It highlights the need for more supportive funding right at the beginning, pre-seed, Series A. That's crucial.
And Marcus Kalbetzer mentioned something about companies listing on the ASX too early.
Yeah, a concern that some might go public before they're really ready, potentially burning through a lot of mom and dad's money.
Yeah.
It's a delicate balance getting that timing right. So funding, especially early on, is a real bottleneck.
Okay, a critical money issue.
Yeah.
What else? What about focus? Are Aussie startups thinking big enough, globally enough?
That's another key challenge. Making sure startups are globally focused right from day one.
Mm.
Brad Parsons and Joshua Flannery stress this. The domestic market is just too small for most ambitious tech companies.
But where should they focus? Still mainly the US and UK.
Well, Steve Grace highlighted a significant underfocus on Asia, which is right on our doorstep. Often put down to maybe cultural alignment being easier with the West, or just a lack of education and understanding about those massive Asian markets. Huge potential being missed there.
Interesting. So broadening horizons geographically and culturally, what about once a company is actually up and running? Is there enough help for the challenges after the launch, the scaling part?
Yeah, Brad Parsons called these the day two challenges. Getting beyond the initial launch, actually scaling the business that's incredibly complex. And he feels there needs to be more support specifically for that phase.
Not just about getting seed funding, but about building a sustainable company.
Exactly. And there's a call for more accessible, maybe even free, education for founders. Democratizing that knowledge. Plus, Steve Grace talked about better talent retention. making sure early employees can keep hold of their equity, giving them a real long-term incentive to stay in the startup game, keep that talent circulating.
That makes total sense. The journey definitely doesn't end with the first check. It gets harder. What about the bigger picture commercialization, partnerships between startups and, say, government or big corporates?
Still room for improvement there. Dharmika Mistry feels collaboration, especially between universities and industry, still isn't good enough. Needs a deeper cultural shift.
And Wayne Girard had that great line.
Customers, not grants.
Yeah, powerful stuff. He's urging government and big companies to genuinely partner with startups, not just buy from them occasionally or give them a grant.
What's the difference in his view?
A partnership creates real, sustainable revenue and growth for the startup. It builds a market. A grant is often just a one-off injection. It's about true collaboration, mutual benefit, not just procurement. Customers, not grants. That really cuts to the chase, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, wrapping up, let's distill all this wisdom. For anyone listening who's maybe got that spark, that idea, what's the key advice from all these experienced voices?
Okay, number one, definitely build diverse networks. Dharmika Mistry hammered this home. Too many people sit in their little bubbles and silos, those connections. They're your lifeline, future co-founders, mentors, investors.
Absolutely crucial. What else?
Embrace the long haul. This isn't easy. Dharmika Mistry and Pauline Fatoi both talked about needing stamina, self-awareness about your own limits, and just sheer resilience. As Pauline said, it's not as cool as all the internet articles.
Mm-hmm. A good dose of reality is always needed. Anything else jump out?
Well, Brad Parsons' point, never stop learning. From your wins, from your stuff-ups, always be learning.
And the validation piece seems critical, too, before you build anything.
Yes. Pauline Fatoui, Alex Gandura, Megan Seven, they all stress this. Work quickly to understand whether your problem is worth solving. Talk to customers before you spend ages building this solution.
Which ties into Peter Tippett's advice, right? Just start, but be serious, talk about your ideas, don't hide behind NDAs.
Exactly. It's about smart action. Start fast, yes, but validate as you go. Be open. And related to that, Eloise Hall emphasized being honest and transparent builds trust, builds a solid foundation.
And finally, Rick Richardson, the inventor, had an interesting take for people who are maybe more technical.
Yeah, he suggested that if you're the problem solver, the inventor type, you should partner with experienced business people to actually execute effectively. Know your strengths and find people who complement them.
Makes sense. Play to your strengths, build a team for the rest.
So where does this all leave us? We've seen the journey from almost nothing to this, you know, rapidly maturing, really collaborative force.
Yeah, we've seen how big events like the pandemic actually sped things up, pushed things towards being more global, more diverse. And those unique strengths that give first attitude, the niche industries, they really shine through. But challenges definitely remain. That early funding gap, breaking into more global markets beyond the usual suspects, truly bridging that academia-industry divide.
Absolutely. The future seems to hinge on, well, continuous learning, really genuine collaboration, and just being willing to challenge how things are done, embracing both our local strengths and pushing for that global ambition.
Which brings us to the final thought, really, for you listening. What more can you do to contribute to this ecosystem as it keeps evolving?
Yeah, maybe it's actively seeking out diverse connections, daring to think globally right from the start, or maybe championing those early stage companies that often get overlooked. Your participation, however small it seems, really does shape the next chapter for Australian innovation.